During the final days of 1983, I had the privilege of visiting the Jerusalem Chamber in Westminster Abbey in London. The Jerusalem Chamber was the scene where some of the work on the authorized version of the Bible took place. But even more significantly for Presbyterians, the Jerusalem Chamber was the place where the Westminster Assembly convened from 1643 to 1648. That assembly conducted its deliberations during some of the most momentous times in English history. Civil war had erupted between those who were loyal to King Charles I and those who were loyal to the Protestants, particularly the Puritans, who dominated the House of Commons in the Parliament. Though he had only lately come to national prominence, the commander of the parliamentary forces in that civil war often found himself wishing for a return to his quieter days as a country farmer and a landlord. But there was no escaping the public attention that was being lavished on Oliver Cromwell. He had turned the ragtag troops of the Parliament into an impressive fighting force, and indeed had developed techniques, tactics of battlefield engagement, especially with mounted troops, cavalry, that had not really been employed. And he had led those forces to inflict one defeat after another on the army of the king. By the time the Westminster Assembly had concluded its work, publishing the Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechisms, King Charles I was a prisoner in his own palace of St. James in London. Soon thereafter, he would be put on trial and deposed as king, refusing the jurisdiction of the parliamentary commission that was set up to try him. He would be condemned by that commission as a traitor and sentenced to death. On January the 30th, 1649, the sentence was carried out, and Charles Stuart, as he was called then, was beheaded. In the hallway outside the Jerusalem Chamber on that day, near the end of 1983, the tour guide pointed out a large table. There was nothing apparently remarkable about it. It was sitting off to the side of the corridor. But he said that that table had been the resting place for the body of Oliver Cromwell after his death in September 1658. The enduring legacy of Cromwell is hard to miss, especially in the area of the Houses of Parliament. Out in front of the building where the House of Commons meets is a large statue of Oliver Cromwell, representing the fact that he was largely responsible for making the House of Commons the linchpin of power in the development of modern England. But at the time of his death, 350 years ago, Cromwell was a man who stirred the passions of every member of English society. Very few had a neutral attitude when it came to Oliver Cromwell. Those who favored the monarchy and who hated the legacy of the Reformation and who despised the Puritans loathed Oliver Cromwell. Those, on the other hand, who treasured the Reformation and the liberties it had revived for the people honored the memory of Oliver Cromwell. They buried his body in Westminster Abbey, an honor that was reserved only for the elite members of English society. Cromwell was not even a nobleman. But when the monarchy was restored in 1660, just 2 years later, one of the first acts of King Charles II, the son of the beheaded king, was to order the body of Cromwell removed from the abbey and to sever the head from the rest of the body. No one knows for sure now where the trunk of Cromwell's body is buried. Some speculation that it may be somewhere near the Marble Arch in London. But his head was passed from one collector to another for 300 years until 1960, when it was buried at the chapel of Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge University, a college that Cromwell had attended for just a year or so. It's appropriate, in a very bizarre way, that Cromwell's remains should have been bandied about as they were. Even to this day, the mention of his name in England is likely to evoke either words of admiration and respect or hoots of derision and disdain. Some historians have described Cromwell as the man who ruined 17th century England to such an extent that it still has not recovered. Others, including Antonia Fraser, not a great admirer of Cromwell, have referred to him, as she did in her historical biography of him, as our chief of men. And if you want to read something about Cromwell, and you're not intimidated by a book that in paperback has over 700 pages, then I would recommend this work by Antonia Fraser on the life of Cromwell. She is not completely sympathetic to him, displaying in her account of King Charles's death quite a bit of sympathy for him. But nevertheless, as far as thoroughness of treatment and the effort to present Cromwell as a man and to try to understand his thinking, it has been reviewed as one of the great works of historical biography. When we look at the life of Cromwell and his career, we find that the reason he has engendered so much disagreement was that he was a man of firm convictions. Now, that should hardly be a surprise. He was a man who believed the gospel of Jesus Christ. He was a man who believed in the values, in the ethics of the Puritan movement. A man who would not hesitate when he saw trappings of Anglicanism in the church in his own community where he worshipped he would not hesitate to get up and to demand that those things be removed as an affront to God. Well, those beliefs made him a natural target for those who did not share them. Those who were enamored of the life of the courtier, who favored the life of perversion, regarded Cromwell's upright living with great suspicion. But at the end of the day, Oliver Cromwell became an instrument in the hands of God to preserve the heritage that the earlier Protestant reformers had done so much to advance, even at the cost of their lives. We're dealing with the legacy of the Reformation. And as I have suggested, Cromwell is often associated with what is called the Second English Reformation, the Puritan movement that believed that the First Reformation under Cranmer and Ridley and Latimer had been cut short by the persecution under Queen Mary until before it could achieve a complete reformation. Though, so in the 17th century, the Puritans sought to advance that work, and Cromwell became allied with them. But there is every reason for us to consider Oliver Cromwell this evening as England's chief man. And I want you to think upon that theme with me. There are great ironies associated with the life of Oliver Cromwell, not the least of which is he did not plan to die when he did. Not many people do. But I think we could say that it took him by as much surprise as it took everybody else. He had not prepared adequately for what would happen after his death. When he realized he was dying, literally in the last hours of his life, he designated his son, Richard, one of the sons who had survived the civil wars. He designated his son Richard as his successor, as Lord Protector. But Richard lasted in that position less than 6 months. In fact, some of the men who marched in Oliver Cromwell's funeral procession in September 1658, or in November, as it turned out, 1658, led the forces that overthrew Richard Cromwell in March 1659, just a few months later. And that overthrow, that coup, as some have called it, paved the way the following year for the restoration of the monarchy and the return of Charles II to be the King of England. Now, all of this history unfolded as a backdrop to other events. We're talking about the 17th century. What was going on during the 17th century in North America? The colonization of the North American continent. In fact, it was as a result of the death of James I, who had despised the Puritans and whose contempt really was the motivating factor in the Puritans going to form what was called then the Massachusetts Bay Colony, later became just Massachusetts. They settled in the area now known as Boston. It was the death of James I and the need of Charles I to cultivate some support from that group that led to a lessening of pressure and a temporary abatement in the migration of the Puritans to the New World. So that was going on during this period. Also in the 17th century, during the time of the Civil Wars, as I have suggested, there was going on in Scotland the work to consolidate the Reformation. In fact, during the reign of Charles II, we find the second major phase of the covenanting period in Scotland. And we've already spoken about that. So we can say that Cromwell's period in history marked the beginning of the climactic phase in England to consolidate the gains of the Reformation. And that would end in yet another revolution and the deposing of another Stuart king, James II. By the forces loyal to William and Mary in 1688, just 30 years after Cromwell's death. When we look at the life of Oliver Cromwell, it falls clearly into three phases. His early years and his relative obscurity as a young adult. Then, his years in Parliament, principally his years as commander of the Parliament's army in the Civil War, and then his years in government following the execution of King Charles I. So you cannot really consider Cromwell without looking at those three phases, because all of those go together to make up the kind of man he was. I think it's well, when we consider the text that we have read this evening in Hebrews 12, to understand that Cromwell, in his day, was conscious of those witnesses of the Protestant Reformation that had gone on before him, many of whom had been put to death by a previous monarch. He understood that he was, as it were, the inheritor of that great legacy. And he understood that the only way he could succeed was the way in which they had succeeded, and that was by keeping his eyes on the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, let us take up the first phase of his life then, the phase that I call out of obscurity. I call it that because if you had looked at his early life, you would never have guessed he would have been such a prominent individual. You would never have guessed he would be England's chief man. Oliver Cromwell was born on April 25th, 1599. That was the very year in which the most famous edition of the Geneva Bible was published, the edition that was carried on the Mayflower and other ships to the New World. His early life, his childhood, growing up years, was not very remarkable at all. His parents were property owners of modest means. They had a lesser rank. They were not nobility. They were people who, by reason of their hard labor, had gained enough to be able to secure some property. And that gave them some status in society. And because of that status, and because of the income that they derived from their property, they were able to arrange for their son Oliver to have an education in a grammar school. Now, when I speak of a grammar school, I'm not talking about the elementary schools with which we are acquainted today. A grammar school was called that because students who went there learned Latin grammar. They really didn't study English. That was not considered essential. After all, they were supposed to speak English. That was their native language, so they didn't see a need to study it. But they were taught Latin grammar. So he went to a grammar school. The teacher in Latin was called the pedantus, the pedant, and he put his young charges through their paces. It was very similar to a school in which William Shakespeare had been taught a generation before. For William Shakespeare was at the height of his power as a playwright during the growing up years of Oliver Cromwell. In 1617, Oliver Cromwell entered Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge, at Cambridge University. That was in 1616, I should say, that he entered that college. In 1617, the following year, his father died. And that meant that his mother needed his help in order to be able to take care of their farm and other properties that they owned. And so Cromwell, as no doubt would be the experience of many others after him, had to abandon his college education, to which he never returned. And he went home and began to help his widowed mother. And that may explain why Cromwell became so devoted to his widowed mother. And she really lived until just a few years before his death. And during her latter years, she lived in his home, even for a time in Hampton Court Palace, when Cromwell was the Lord Protector. When he was 21 years old, and this was in the year 1620, that was the year when the pilgrims sailed on the Mayflower to the New World. In 1620, Cromwell got married. He married a young woman whose name was Elizabeth Fourchier. She was from a family that had property in another area of England, but also had property in London itself. They were married. We don't know exactly how they met, perhaps in the social occasions that property-owning families sometimes attended. They may have met. But they were married, and they set about establishing their family home. Now, we have no doubt that they were religious. That was an accepted part of society. You were religious. You went to the Church of England. You went to the Anglican Church. That was part of being in society. But about 5 years after they were married, there came a turning point in Cromwell's life. It came around 1626, when, in the words of some historians, he had some kind of religious experience. It's interesting to read secular historians trying to explain this kind of thing. He had some kind of religious experience, following which they said he became very zealous about God. Well, we can know what that experience was, for his life was never the same afterward. He came to personal faith in Jesus Christ. We don't know exactly how it happened, except that he no doubt had been exposed to the influence of some of the Puritans, and no doubt had heard the gospel. In the words of our text this evening, he began at that point looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of his faith. He began to appreciate, following his conversion, the positions that were articulated by Puritan leaders like John Owen, with whom he was very familiar. And he became thankful through their influence for the sacrifices that the Protestant reformers of previous generations had made so that he could have access to the truth of the gospel. Cromwell became very ardent in his devotion to that truth and to the impact he believed it should have on the lives of those around him. He was a farmer, as I said, and he kept to himself. He would have been quite happy to stay on his farm for the rest of his life and to take care of his family. He was known as a quiet man. He didn't normally speak up. But it was said that when he did so with authority. And he compelled others to listen to him just by the manner with which he spoke. He became a justice of the peace in his local area. And on one occasion, he went to the local tavern, the local pub in the town. Yes, they had those back then. And he detained a group of people who were drunk. And they were making a disturbance. They were carrying on. And he detained them. And he required them to join him in singing a hymn. And so they had to do that. And that was his way of communicating with them concerning the truth. Later on, he was called to help calm a disturbance among the students. Yes, this was in the 17th century, at Cambridge University, which was not too far away. And his Puritan neighbors were so impressed with the way he handled himself that when the next election for Parliament came around, they chose him to be their representative in Parliament. And so he had to make the long journey from Cambridge to London to join the Parliament. That was in 1628. He was not yet 30 years old. Now, it's interesting that he was also well acquainted with two other leading nonconformists of the period. He was well known to John Bunyan. In fact, John Bunyan was a soldier who fought in the Civil War under Cromwell's command. John Milton, the Puritan poet, was Cromwell's secretary, his secretary for his military and political matters. So that gives you some sense of the kind of people with whom Cromwell was familiar. So he went to Parliament in 1628. The following year, in 1629, the king dissolved Parliament and did not call it into session again for 11 years. Now, that election in 1628 was to prove the means, though no one knew it at the time, of catapulting Oliver Cromwell into real prominence in the nation. And that brings me to the second phase of his life, what I call into the battle. As I have said, the Parliament to which he had been elected was dissolved by King Charles I in 1629, and Cromwell went home. There was no meeting of Parliament. So he had no business there. He went back to his farm and he picked up where he left off doing his work on his farm. Now, Charles I had been king for only 4 years. His father, James I, died in 1625. And so from the 4-year mark of his reign to the 15-year mark of his reign, Charles ruled without calling Parliament into session. The only reason he needed Parliament at any time was if he needed money, if he needed taxes to be raised. And so he had enough in his treasury. He didn't call them into session. He despised the Puritan leaders of the Parliament. And he resolved that he would govern by the divine right that James, his father before him, had impressed upon him. But, as often happens with politicians, they usually develop a need at some point for more revenues. So he did. And Charles was forced by his war policies that were bleeding his treasury, he was forced to call Parliament into session to get more funds for the crown. Now the Puritan members of the Parliament, already stinging from the dissolution of the Parliament 11 years before, were very deeply suspicious of the king's motives. They believed that he was secretly pursuing the goal of re-establishing Roman Catholicism as the state religion in England. And their suspicions were not unfounded. In 1640, the king called for a parliament to be elected, and again Cromwell was elected to represent his neighbors in the Cambridge area. That parliament was called the Short Parliament because once the king had achieved his objective, he dissolved it again. But then he had a need the same year for more money, and so another election was called. And Cromwell was elected again to a parliament that became known as the Long Parliament because it refused to adjourn even on the orders of the king. Eventually, the king decided to put an army in the field to force his will upon the people at large. And that touched off a civil war. The Puritans in Parliament called for an army of their own. And so they got together a collection of soldiers, and they went out to fight the king's army. And in the first battle, it was a total disaster. The parliamentary forces were routed, many of them were killed, and immediately, the leaders of Parliament saw that something was going to have to change if they really wanted to take on the king. And so they made Oliver Cromwell the general. Now, Cromwell had seen the weakness of the army, and though he himself had never been trained in military tactics or strategy, he determined that he would organize the cavalry, and he trained a group of 1,000 farmers in the art of infantry fighting. They were called the Iron Brigade because it was said that they were impervious to assault on the battlefield. J. Rogers described Cromwell's army in this way. It was an army the likes of which hadn't been seen since ancient Israel. They would recite the Westminster Confession and march into battle singing the Psalms of David, striking terror into the heart of the enemy. Cromwell's tactic was to strike with the cavalry through the advancing army at the center, go straight through the lines, and then circle to either the left or the right, milling the mass into a mob, creating confusion and utterly destroying them. Cromwell amassed a body of troops and soon became commander-in-chief. His discipline created the only body of regular troops on either side who preached, prayed, paid fines for profanity and drunkenness, and charged the enemy singing hymns. The strangest abnormality in an age when every vice imaginable characterized soldiers and mercenaries. Now you begin to get some sense of Cromwell's influence, the kind of impact he had upon those men who fought under his command. Now, some of the other commanders were certainly not of the same stripe, but those who fought under Cromwell's orders would observe that discipline. Now, right away, the forces of the Civil War turned, and the king's armies began to suffer disastrous defeats. And he had a need for more soldiers, and there weren't too many to be found. So he turned to Ireland and agreed to pay a certain number of Irish soldiers to come across the Irish Sea to England and to fight against the parliamentary forces. And that only added to the perception that he was trying to undo the Reformation, that he was seeking to reestablish Romanism. And when the parliamentary forces finally prevailed, Charles I became their prisoner and was eventually charged with high treason and was sentenced to death. And as I have said, early in 1649, he was put to death, as many said, displaying more dignity and nobility in the hour of his death than he had ever displayed in his life. And then came the final phase of Cromwell's life, the phase that I call On to the Glory. Some had wanted, in the aftermath of the execution of King Charles, to make Cromwell the king. They said the people were used to having a king, and Cromwell was the one who should be the king. But he refused resolutely. He said that they had just fought a civil war. In fact, two civil wars they had fought to establish the principle that Parliament was to govern the land, not the king. And so he went back home. But over the several years that followed, those who were left from the Long Parliament, and this was a group that came to be called the Rump Parliament, they showed that they were not up to the task of governing the land. Corruption began to appear again. Infighting began to appear again. And so in 1653, Cromwell led the members of his army to the Parliament in London and said that they had forfeited their right to sit there, and he ordered his army to clear the building. And they did so. He had dissolved the Parliament. And he had himself installed as the protector of the realm. Now, he refused the crown again. But he did assume a lot of royal prerogatives. And yet he used his power in a way that was far different from the power that had been exercised by the king, Charles I. Cromwell used his power to improve English society, to reform it, to foster education especially, because Cromwell desired that every child growing up in England would learn to read so he could read the Bible. He was desirous of ensuring the liberties of the people because he saw that as a byproduct of what the reformers had accomplished. In 1657, he was declared the Lord Protector. And at that point, many people did treat him as though he were the king. But in 1658, his health began to fail. There was a lot of trouble with malaria in England at that time. And he had developed a fever that was thought to be related to malaria. And very suddenly he declined and died on September 3rd, 1658. His death was a great shock to those who had supported him because no one knew what to do then. There was an elaborate state funeral that was designed after the funeral of King James I, more than 30 years before. But it did not take place until more than 2 months after Cromwell's death. On November 10th, his body was buried in the crypt in Westminster Abbey. And they created an elaborate effigy, as they called it, of his body for the purpose of the state funeral that took place on November 23rd, when it was said that the procession was so elaborate that it took them the better part of 7 hours for the procession to make 1 mile coming to Westminster Abbey. In every respect, it was a royal funeral, except that Cromwell was not a royal figure. He was a commoner. The aftermath, as I have said, was sad. His son, one of his sons who was not killed during the civil wars, his son became Lord Protector in his father's place and lasted only a few months. And then, without any executive figure in the country, the people began to yearn for the days when they had had a king. And in 1660, Charles II was brought back and crowned as King of England. Cromwell, though, had a legacy that not even Charles could erase. Cromwell's legacy was that he had established the principle that the children of England should be educated, they should be taught to read, and that it should not be just those who had the financial means to do so, but that all the children should be taught to read. And he ordered the disposition of government funds to that end, so that his legacy would end up being preserved in that more and more children, as they grew up, would learn to read the Scriptures. And having read the Scriptures, would then come under the power of the Scriptures. And then ultimately would turn against the designs of the Stuart family. When Charles II died in 1685, he was succeeded by his brother, James II, who was in every way a Roman Catholic. And that was more than the people who had benefited from Cromwell's legacy would endure. And so they sent messengers across to Holland, where they entered into negotiations with William of Orange and his wife Mary. William of Orange came to England in 1688 and was accorded the throne. And after 2 years of fighting, the last Stuart family was removed from influence in England. Cromwell then had achieved a great deal. And that is why, to this day, many look upon him as the chief of men in English history. Because he did what others could not do. He made a change not only in the government, but in the society. And would see to it that not for hundreds of years would anyone ever begin to entertain the idea that a monarch in England could be a Roman Catholic. It is a measure of the extent to which Cromwell's legacy is being forgotten today that there are those now in England who are entertaining the idea of making it possible for a Roman Catholic to be on the throne of that country. On to the glory Cromwell went. And though many despise him and mock him now, he was a man who was looking unto Jesus. And looking unto Jesus, he continued until there was no more for him to do. And then he could say, I have finished my course. I have kept the faith.